Hello there. Today is Thursday, October 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the fallout, even from his closest allies, continues over the president's decision to withdraw the U.S. from Syria.
This is a national security disaster. It's going to be a nightmare for Israel. And if you don't understand that, you're not listening to your own people.
More witnesses testify to Congress as part of the impeachment inquiry into Trump's efforts to have Ukraine investigate Joe Biden. Also ahead, Katy Perry gives her fans an unexpected gift. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is defending his Syria troop pullout, even as lawmakers from both parties sharply criticize the move. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
I wish him all a lot of luck.
Amid a crisis that followed his decision to pull American troops out, the president says it's not the U.S.'s fight. He's been accused of abandoning the Kurds, who fought alongside America but are now being targeted by Turkey. He says it's all working out brilliantly because Syria is keeping the Kurds safe.
Plus, they know how to fight. And by the way, they're no angels.
As for whether Russia will get involved, the president says that would be fine. Just keep the U.S. out of it.
They've got a lot of sand over there, so there's a lot of sand that they can play with.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Well, Trump on Wednesday called in congressional leadership to discuss the situation in Syria, not long after the House of Representatives, in a rare bipartisan rebuke, voted overwhelmingly to oppose the president's announced troop withdrawal in Syria. But as Democratic leaders sat down with Trump, it turned into a very explosive meeting, including name-calling and anger that ended abruptly with Democrats walking out of the meeting at the White House. Democrats later held a news conference where Representative Steny Hoyer said they're deeply offended by the president's comments aimed at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I have served with six presidents. I have been in many, many, many meetings like this. Never have I seen a president treat so disrespectfully a co-equal branch of the government of the United States.
Well, Pelosi seemed to feel the anger was born out of the bipartisan vote condemning the president's decision on Syria.
I think that vote, the size of the vote, more than 2-1 of the Republicans voted to oppose what the president did, probably got to the president because he was shaken up by it.
Trump's action has opened the door for a Turkish military attack on Syrian Kurds who've been aligned with the U.S. in fighting the country's longest war. Meanwhile, there is also a French component to the story of what's happening in Syria. France's foreign minister is heading to Iraq to discuss the prospect of the thousands of suspected so-called Islamic State jihadists escaping or being freed by the Kurds who've been guarding them. Joining us to talk about that part of the story is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what can you tell us?
France is very concerned, their particular concern in regards to their own nationals who were in the region, who were fighting with so-called ISIS. They are in Kurdish-run prisons in northern Syria. The French foreign minister says that France is particularly concerned that these foreign fighters may be released as the Kurdish fighters have to withdraw, or they could be just left there, in which case they might release themselves, or they could be taken prisoner by the Syrians. Now, what the French do not want to happen, they do not want any risk that these foreign fighters, these French nationals in the region, to be allowed to run free. What they're really concerned about is that they could regroup, could be part of some group that would set up again a sort of Islamic State type operation within Syria, or, and here's the really dangerous point, French, that they could make their way back to France. Already in September, we had Interpol saying that they detected at least a dozen suspected foreign fighters coming across the Mediterranean in boats. The idea that these foreign fighters could escape and travel back to Europe or stay in Syria and regroup as part of Islamic State is very concerning.
What about President Trump's comments recently when this whole thing unfolded that we don't want them here, let them go to Europe, these fighters?
The issue of returning foreign fighters has been very prevalent in Europe, and it is mostly because, let us not forget, the terrorist attacks that took place in Paris and in Brussels in 2015 and 2016 involved those foreign fighters, fighters who returned from Syria, who came back with knowledge, who came back with the connections to be able to carry out these terror attacks. Here in France, where several hundred people died at a range of attacks that went on for more than a year. So there is not even any will in France to bring these fighters back and to have them seen to in French courts, because the concern is that they would not have the evidence to be able to try them properly here. But even if they did have some evidence, they would be then forced to have a custodial sentence. Now, French prisons are overcrowded. This would mean that they would be in with other fighters, perhaps, and that they would be able to get, again, another cell working within the prison, radicalize other prisoners as they're able to operate once they get out of prison. So there is really no appetite in France for these fighters to be able to come home.
How will this transfer take place if it does, in fact, if France is able to make this happen, and who will pay for it?
Well, that's a good question, and that is why the French foreign minister is going out to Iraq. What they want to do is they want to help the Iraqis to set up some sort of judicial framework which would enable those foreign fighters in Syria to face trial in Iraq. This is a very tall order because of the instability that is happening in Iraq. As well, there is no structure there. There is no alternative structure for a sort of an international tribunal for these fighters to face justice. On top of that, Iraq does have the death penalty, and France has always said it will not allow any of its nationals to go to countries which has the death penalty. It doesn't allow it in France. So those are the two main problems. And as you rightly say, who would move these people from Syria over to Iraq? It's believed there's some 550 French and Belgian nationals in that group of foreign fighters. Most of those would have to be moved. Who would do that? At the moment, all eyes are on French special forces who are in the region. Would they be moved into Kurdish-controlled areas, get those prisoners and move them over to Iraq? And indeed, would that movement of prisoners who still haven't had their day in court, would that even be legal?
This sounds like it could potentially be also a dangerous effort, given that Turkey doesn't seem to have any plans to slow its offensive down. Besides that concern as far as the safety, what is the overall feeling in France and across Europe, as far as you can tell, about what has transpired due to a decision by the President of the United States?
There is a feeling that Europe needs to stand up on this. There is a feeling that the United States has let Europe down. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, had always thought that they had an agreement, that this was an international coalition that was going to stand firm, that was going to see the job done. So it did come as an enormous surprise when President Trump of the United States announced there would be this withdrawal. So what the French in particular are doing, along with some of the other European nations, is they're going around the other Europeans and saying, please, can we try and keep this coalition together? Don't pay any notice to what the Americans done. We have to stay together, because if this situation deteriorates any more in Syria than what it is already, then there is not just the risk of instability in that region, there's also the risk of millions more refugees, migrants, people fleeing that area looking for safety in Europe.
All right. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. renews its call for a humane solution to Hong Kong's continuing protests. The Democratic leadership walks out of a White House meeting with President Trump. British authorities say hundreds have been arrested in the child pornography site takedown. And a Cameroonian chemist is turning pollution into soap. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump intensified Wednesday as lawmakers returned to Washington after a two-week recess. As VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Capitol Hill, House Democrats face growing questions about the timeline and scope of the inquiry.
A busy week of interviews for House Democrats building a case for articles of impeachment.
Oh, I don't think we're there at all yet. We have a lot more things to go on and to do, and we're doing it.
The original whistleblower complaint alleging the president withheld aid to Ukraine in return for help against rival Joe Biden and his son, giving House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff a guide to request court orders for additional information, orders the Trump administration has so far refused.
The case for obstruction of Congress continues to build.
Trump arguing he won't cooperate until House Democrats hold a floor vote to make the inquiry official. That's a game to undermine Congress, said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We're not here to call bluffs. We're here to find the truth, to uphold the Constitution of the United States.
But the president said Pelosi and Democrats were playing politics.
This one is just absolutely crazy. All you have to do is read the transcript of the call. Read the transcript. This is a open and shut, simple case. They're desperate because they know they're going to lose the election.
Schiff, also a focus of Republicans' frustration, facing a formal vote of disapproval introduced by Trump's congressional ally.
There's nothing that the president did wrong. There's nothing that the president did within that call that's impeachable. And you know what? If the speaker would have waited 48 hours to have the transcript, we wouldn't be putting America through this.
Democrats face pressure to hold an impeachment vote by year's end, avoiding the official start of the 2020 presidential election in February. Still, some said time shouldn't be a concern.
It's important to take note that we're not rushing so that we give any impression that we're happy at doing this, that this is a celebration, that all we want to do is to move the president in or out.
Democrats' next step, learning more about the text exchanges between Trump officials, including former European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland, set to testify Thursday. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And meanwhile, more arrests were reported Wednesday as part of the investigation into the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and his affairs in Ukraine, part of what led to the impeachment inquiry. As we learn, the probe includes a counterterrorism element. Joining us for that part of the story is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Government and Policy. Thank you for being with us. Explain to us exactly what a counterterrorism investigation may indicate.
What's really interesting and complicating all this is that the core issue is the impeachment being run out of Capitol Hill. But then in addition, there are these other investigations going on. The one you were just referring to is coming out of the Southern District of New York. Ironically enough, that's the U.S. Attorney's Office Rudy Giuliani headed many years ago. What I think may be going on is to see, is Mr. Giuliani, who claims he's not being paid by the president, is he being paid by foreign interests? And could those foreign interests be doing something that is making the intelligence folks very nervous? You know, I'm speculating.
What would make them nervous?
The concern could be who is paying Mr. Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Giuliani is not, you know, yes, he's not being paid by the president, but it doesn't mean he's independently wealthy and therefore can just, you know, do whatever good deeds for people he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's paying him. The FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office would really want to know who is paying him, because that can raise counterintelligence concerns. If he's being paid by a foreign entity of some sort, a governmental entity, that would raise certainly counterintelligence concerns, because then he's effectively representing the interests of another country, and he is not registered as a foreign agent.
We're also learning that a Florida man wanted in this campaign finance case involving associates of Rudy Giuliani was arrested Wednesday. What does this say?
Well, again, I think this is a broad inquiry by the grand jury in the Southern District of New York. I should mention that that's one of the two or three very most important U.S. attorney's offices in the country. It's big, it's prestigious to work there, and they can have very broad-ranging inquiries, often having to do with money. The Southern District of New York includes Southern Manhattan, meaning, you know, Wall Street. It seems to me that the concern here is purely the money. Where is this money coming from? For example, there has been talk that the two of those folks that have been arrested were involved in money laundering. It is against the law for foreigners, that is non-U.S. citizens, or certainly foreign governments or foreign companies, to contribute money to U.S. campaign. The allegation appears to be that money from some European interests has been laundered and been provided to people in this country running for election.
Well, the other development in the whole impeachment inquiry over the president asking Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden, we had last week learned that the former top aide to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Michael McKinley, resigned, and now he's just wrapped up testimony before a House committee in the impeachment inquiry. He had several concerns, from what we understand, that he talked about, that State Department officials were discouraging people from testifying, not supporting diplomats who received subpoenas, and apparently were trying to keep career diplomats and other national security officials involved in foreign affairs from getting in the way of this whole campaign or apparent campaign to get Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden. It's interesting because as hard as the White House has been working to not cooperate in the investigation, it seems like one after the other, we are still seeing that Democrats are getting career government officials to come in and talk to them about what they've been seeing so far.
And some not even career. Look, this almost always happens in a broad-scale inquiry, particularly one involving political issues. And when I say this, what I mean is people volunteering, coming out of the woodwork, even if they haven't been identified, even if they haven't been subpoenaed, they will volunteer to come to congressional committees. Again, this is not unique to this event. This has happened in every one of these large-scale investigations. And there are two different reasons for it. On the one hand, people don't necessarily have the loyalty to the president. It's not that they're disloyal, but these are career people. They don't care much one way or the other. They will serve loyally for any president so long as the president is acting properly. The flip side of it is that these are people that don't want to find their careers or their reputations sullied by their apparent involvement in something that may be distasteful. And so as soon as the whistleblower came forward and that complaint became public, people witnessing this are going to say, well, wait a minute, I don't want to be associated with that, and they will come forward and volunteer, and that is happening now.
All right, Dr. Robert Deitz, Professor of Governmental Affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Government and Policy. European Union and British negotiators failed to reach a breakthrough deal in Brexit talks during a frantic 11th-hour all-night session on the eve of an EU summit. Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony reports.
Last-ditch Brexit negotiations have come to a standstill, according to EU sources. And Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said on Wednesday that talks so far have failed to resolve the issues standing in the way of a civilised divorce. The sticking point for both sides, trade and the status of the Irish border. Talks have dragged on, and any hope of a deal could be shattered if the British House of Commons failed to approve it later down the line. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has repeatedly vowed to take Britain out of the EU on October 31st, with or without a deal. A message reiterated by Brexit Minister Stephen Barclay, who said earlier on Wednesday that he would not accept a Brexit delay, even if it was only used to tie up the necessary legal requirements of an agreement. If no compromise can be met, the EU believes the UK will be forced to delay its departure for a third time. They may hold an emergency summit later in October to either approve a deal, grant an extension, or make preparations for a chaotic departure.
Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony. Tuesday was World Food Day, a day the United Nations has set aside to heighten awareness about hunger worldwide. Its aim is also to promote action that can end malnutrition, which is responsible for tens of millions of deaths worldwide every year. To find out what one prominent NGO is doing to lead the fight to end hunger, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Charles Owuba, CEO of Action Against Hunger, which helps communities detect malnutrition in children and provide holistic care with nutrient-rich candy bars, among other things. Bua, who experienced hunger as a child in rural Ghana, began the conversation by summing up the current state of hunger across the globe.
We did a study asking more than 1,000 Americans from all walks of life their understanding of hunger.
And what did you find?
Their knowledge of hunger varied, but overall, they didn't think it was that serious at all. I'll give you an example. We asked them, for them to give us an estimate of what they thought would be the number of children dying through hunger.
Globally.
They told us, on the average, only about 2,000 children are dying of hunger every day. Actually, it's 8,000 children die of hunger every day. Last year alone, about 821 million people went hungry last year. 50 million children today are acutely malnourished, meaning if we do not help them, these children will die. That's unacceptable.
It kind of stands to reason that most Americans, you know, in this land of plenty, would have a poor general idea of how extensive the problem of hunger is worldwide.
You're right. What is interesting is that from this survey, we realize that when we give them the facts, as many as 77% of them care so much and they wanted to help.
Is there some kind of area of help that you'd recommend that they engage in, like giving money or sending food or working with a nonprofit or an NGO to end poverty?
It's interesting you raise that question because most Americans thought that the issue of deadly hunger is about food. And we explained it's not about food. It's a medical issue. Just food alone is not going to solve the issue. Issue of sanitation is important. The water they drink is important. Access to health is important. So just giving them the food alone will not cut it. If the child is drinking very dirty water and is going to get diarrhea, whatever the child eats goes out quickly. It doesn't help. If the child has malaria, he or she needs to be treated.
I know you're very hopeful about this plastic band that mothers can use to wrap around their kids' biceps to see how thick they are, which indicates whether they're malnourished or not. Tell us a bit about that.
So it's a very simple band, three colors, green, yellow, and red. Call it nutrition thermometer. Once you wrap around your upper arm, it tells you whether your child is healthy or not healthy based on those colors. So if it's green, your child is healthy. If it's yellow or red, your child is malnourished. So it's a very simple tool that whether you've gone to school or not, you should be able to tell. And so that's what this band actually does.
Right. And then you give the kids this wonderful Plumpy Nut bar, which is so full of peanuts and protein and vitamins and fat and that kind of thing, which gets them on the road to proper health again.
Our study is very clear that when children are diagnosed with this issue, as many as 90% of them through this treatment survive. That is very high, 90%. And then after that, you stay in their community to be able to help them.
Last question. You told me about the global statistics about world hunger. What about Africa? How much hunger is there, and how does it break down by general area, East Africa, West Africa?
Overall, the numbers are quite high, but East Africa is where we're seeing the most numbers. In terms of the prevalence, it's very high in East Africa. And that's where the work that we're doing today. In the near term, we're going to make sure that we double the number of children who need to have access to this treatment in East Africa.
All right. That was VOA's Adam Phillips speaking with Charles Awuba, CEO of Action Against Hunger. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Walking through fire, burning and cutting themselves. These are just a few of the ways thousands of Venezuelans pay tribute to a legendary indigenous goddess. Believers of the cult say it all helps communicate with their ancestors. VOA's Arash Arbasadi tells us more.
A literal Burning Man festival is underway on the Sorte Mountain in Venezuela. Me siento bien, gracias a Dios.
I feel good, thank God. My feet are fine. My body is free of burns.
The annual gathering honors Maria Leonza, an indigenous goddess of nature, love, peace, and harmony. Legend has it she once fought a giant anaconda until the snake exploded, causing torrential downpours common in the region's jungles. Each year, thousands travel to the mountain seeking spiritual connection and, ironically, physical healing.
I thank the Divine Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and my Holy Mother, Queen Maria Leonza, because we worship her once again on the Day of the Indigenous Race.
Healing practices include spitting alcohol on each other and smoking cigars, a practice that supposedly enables smokers to transcend worlds.
Tobacco is a means of communicating with the spirits in various religions, understand? For us, tobacco is the means by which we contact our ancestors, our people, or our mother, Queen Maria Leonza, because through tobacco, we can each get a message on how to live our lives.
People here say the trance-inducing traditions allow them to escape injury from otherwise dangerous activities. The days-long festival represents a counter-event to celebrations of Christopher Columbus. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
American pop singer Katy Perry has released a new single and a sultry music video to go along with it. It's the third song she's released from her upcoming album. In the video, Perry is seen wearing a leather jacket and cruising on a motorcycle in the paradise of Hawaii. Then the scene turns to romance on a beach with a tattooed stranger. The video ends with her snuggling with that handsome stranger man as the sun rises. A clue as to who that mystery man in the video could potentially represent. From her own life, Perry's fiancé Orlando Bloom has been known to cruise around on motorcycles, and the couple have in the past vacationed in Hawaii. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.